Welcome to Always Searching, the podcast challenging conventional wisdom about health and wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. I'm delighted that you're here. My guest is an analog astronaut, space artist, vice president of training at Star Harbor, where we're also colleagues. Welcome to Always Searching, Erin Bonilla.
Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure, Erin. You and I have gotten to know each other through our work with Star Harbor, but I realize I don't really know a lot about your early background. I know that you have been an artist. I think you mentioned to me that you actually came from the fashion world, moved your way into space and training, and so we got a lot to catch up on.
Yeah, definitely. It's been an atypical career to get to spaceflight training.
Well, this is so perfect. You know, Always Searching's focus is to question conventional wisdom in health and wellness, science and technology, as well as looking at how we can realistically transform our lives. So you're perfect, perfect guest for our podcast. Did you ever think that you were going to be in the space world when you came from Canada to the United States? I mean, was that something that was at the forefront of your thoughts? What did you want to do when you were a child?
Yeah, no, space was not on the list for me. You know, I was inspired by space. For example, my brother had his whole wall was a mural of the space shuttle, which is funny to look back on now because I was the one that ended up in aerospace. But No, I grew up as an artist and my parents really encouraged me in that area, which is why I ended up my undergrad was in graphic design. So I had interest at that time to go into fashion advertising. That was the cool thing to do. I was a designer. I loved art. Like fashion is cool. So that was the path that I initially took.
Where were you in college? Where'd you go?
I went to Virginia Tech.
So yeah. You stayed in Virginia and did you eventually work in that world of fashion advertising and design?
I did. It was less glamorous than I thought it was going to be. I did eventually get a role as a creative director at a fashion ad firm. They mostly ran e-commerce websites for different luxury fashion labels. So really small labels. So we would help them get their websites set up and designed set up. And then run all the marketing and advertising campaigns for them.
So it sounded like you were really immersed in that world. What was the turning point for you to think, okay, now I need to move into space?
Yeah. So I actually was having a little crisis. I started to realize that what I was doing was not as fulfilling for me anymore. And the reason is we were advertising, we were selling really expensive jeans to people that may or may not be able to afford those. And it felt, I got into an uncomfortable space. And so I thought, okay, what's that next thing? Like what could I do next? And actually my husband at the time contracted with NASA headquarters and there was a role open to come in and help run a couple of NASA's websites and then do graphic design support and things like that. And so, you know, at first I was like, space, that's not for me. Like, I don't know about that. But actually, he'd been trying to get me to apply for this role for a while. And finally, I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And I happened to know every single person already that was interviewing me for that role. And so I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And it turned out to be like one of the best choices. I like to say I caught the space bug at that point. And it was like no turning back.
Yeah. And when you get infected, there is no cure.
No.
It just stays there. I always tell people when you get connected to the space world, you know, you're there for life. It doesn't change.
Yeah, definitely.
So what was the most really exciting aspect about what you were doing? Were you able to weave what you learned in fashion design, advertising into trying to reach out to the space community?
Yeah, very much so. One thing that I found, I'm really glad I went that path because it gave me that like really solid creative background, but also the advertising side is like, how do you reach people?
Right.
And so what was great for me, like transitioning to space, is then they put me in a role where I was managing social media accounts and educational outreach programs and you know, creating interactive graphics to share with the public complex systems that NASA is working on. And so I was able to use my creative and advertising background to share NASA's message with the public in ways that would capture them. And so, you know, it's interesting. There's a direct parallel in my mind from advertising mm-hmm. and educational outreach that I don't know if everybody always sees that correlation, but like I have direct experience now going from one to the other. And it was like invaluable for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, oftentimes people were like, you know, why are you moving so fast? You know, mm-hmm. why are you able to do this stuff so quickly? And I attribute a lot of that to the background that I had before.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I also have an advertising background, which surprises most people. When mm-hmm. I lived in New York City, I actually worked for a couple ad agencies. I took sort of my sabbatical year between college and med school. I got a couple places in med schools and I thought I need to go do something creative and not just take tests. Yeah. So I worked for some fantastic ad agencies. And I have to say that was probably one of the most valuable experiences. Because when I came into the government, developed educational campaigns, it's all outreach. You don't succeed if the people don't understand the message, right?
Yep.
And then certainly in what we're doing today, we're really ambassadors for this space community. And so you have to convey it in a way that people understand. So I think everyone should do some time in that world.
I agree. And it was, I also would say the pace is so much faster yes. in that industry. Mm-hmm. So having learned how to move at that pace was like a huge asset to me yeah. once I got to a big government agency, because it didn't move that same pace,
no.
but I could find ways to like navigate that in mm-hmm. faster ways. And I think that was, you know, it really helped me, but it also helped the programs that I was working on at the time.
So taking that the next level, you call yourself a space artist. I love that term. How do you define it? What art have you developed and where can we find your pieces?
Yeah. So it's funny. I've been an artist my whole life. In undergrad, I mentioned I did graphic mm-hmm. design, but that also involved a lot of fine arts, painting, drawing, other
fantastic.
Art, yeah, art history, things like that. So I'm like, I'm an artist through and through. The one area that really like I'm passionate about is illustration and really on the computer illustration. And, that, you know, I did a lot of that work at NASA while I was there. But then later, I started to get into like supporting different like space simulation missions mm-hmm. and designing their logos and patches and coins. Like I mm-hmm. did the challenge coin designs for 3 of the 4 Inspiration 4 crew members.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so those, and they flew in space, which is very cool.
That is very cool.
Yeah. So, you know, after enough time, like I started to think, okay, like I'm an artist, but I'm so passionate about space. Like why not put mm-hmm. those two together? Since a lot of the art that I've been producing lately is space themed. I did have as part of Inspiration 4, mm-hmm. There was a NFT auction that they had. And I'm new to the NFT world. It's not something yes. I'm as familiar with, but I was able to submit one of my illustrations, and it's of an analog astronaut or a person participating in space simulation missions. Mm-hmm. And I submitted that, and then it was put up for auction to raise money for St. Jude's. And it sold for the equivalent of $1,100 at the time. So that was kind of cool.
That is really cool.
Yeah. Cause I've never been one to like, you know, put my art in museums mm-hmm. or, you know, like, right. like for auction or things like that. Mm-hmm. And to be able to do it in a way to support a fundraising effort was very cool.
And as we all know, so many artists are, you know, that starving artist term has merit, and to
yes.
be able to sell your artwork and also to have it be really important to help others is really fantastic.
Yeah.
Now you keep bringing up the word analog, and for our always searching team of explorers, can you define what we mean by analog and how have you become an analog astronaut? And not only that, you help others become analog astronauts.
Yeah. Analog is, okay, let me take a step back here. So human space flight, there only so many people are going to space. And the idea is that we're opening up space and more can go eventually, but that population is very small. But there's a whole team of people on Earth that are supporting research, efficacy studies, simulation missions to be able to prepare technologies, people, and other science to go to space, right? Because space is really expensive. You don't want to get up there, a person or an experiment or research, and have it fail, right? Like, you want to be able to get useful data and have a successful mission. And so a lot of that prep happens on Earth. And so by analog, I mean simulated. So here on Earth, we have different habitats. So that, like, throughout the world, actually, there are different facilities that support long duration space research. And so people will go live inside of those habitats for 2 weeks to months, in some cases, a year or year plus, to be able to simulate what would it actually be like to be on the moon or be on Mars. And so when, you know, people and research are inside of those simulations, they are on Mars or the moon. And so they are able to go into, like, mentally into a fully immersive simulated environment. And then the data that comes from that can be used to prove out that we could actually go and live on the moon, live on Mars. And so I myself have participated in several different space analog activities, but I had an opportunity to be the vice commander on a Mars simulation mission at the High Seas Habitat, which is a geodesic dome on the side of Mauna Loa on the Big Island of Hawaii, which is a very Mars-like terrain. You're on volcanic terrain. And so we were in the simulation, and when we would go outside of the habitat, we would put on simulated spacesuits and we would go out, do an EVA, extravehicular activity, and go explore the terrain. And we would go down into lava tubes and, you know, with headlamps and everything. We'd have to use comm systems to communicate with each other. If they were down, we were using nonverbal communication, like hand signals and things like that. So it was a pretty amazing experience for me. In somebody who's now in a position, I'm developing space training programs, is to have had some of that on the inside, hands-on experience, that experiential knowledge of those activities. So,
How many analog missions have you been on?
I've only been on one analog mission, but I have
been... That was the High Seas.
Yeah, that was the High Seas. But I've also participated in other space training activities, which also are considered like space analog environments. So for example, I've been on a parabolic flight, so a weightless flight. I have done scuba certification, which is something that is used in space flight training, is to simulate a microgravity type environment, hypoxia training and hyperbaric chambers. All of these are space simulated or space analog environments. And so activities that happen in those and these habitats, they're all contributing to the future of human spaceflight.
So can everyone participate in this? Can anyone just sign up? What does it take to become an analog astronaut?
Yes, really anybody can participate. Each analog habitat has a different application process. And I know the community is trying to come together to improve this system so it's easier for people to get access. But if you look at each facility, and then usually on their website, they'll have a place where you can apply. One other thing I suggest to people is if you want to do one of these missions, you can plan it too. And go out there and you can propose it to the habitats as well. And a lot of them will accept full missions coming in. Yeah.
Is there a website for analog environment submissions, or do you just have to know people?
Right now, it's not that clear. There is a website mm-hmm. for reference material related to being an analog astronaut. I think it's analogastronaut.com. I'll have to, mm-hmm. to take a look. But and there's a whole community of people now that are calling themselves analog astronauts because they are supporting
you see it all the time.
Yeah, that what astronauts are doing, but here on Earth. And mm-hmm. so it what's great is it's giving them something to identify with, but also yeah. a very supportive community of people that are all doing this stuff together.
So do you have to qualify? Do you have to go through, you know, for example, to be an astronaut, there's just such rigorous evaluation and training. Mm-hmm. Do you have to go through a similar process to be an analog astronaut?
No, I mean, there are some basic requirements that you can't have certain medical conditions depending mm-hmm. on the habitat. Like, for example, if you're going to underwater habitats, like mm-hmm. the Aquarius habitat off the coast of Key Largo, there are more strict because mm-hmm. of the saturation environment you're going into. There are a little bit more strict health requirements. But with the land-based habitats, there really aren't. And you can come from many different backgrounds. And so that's what the benefit there is. The sample size, if you're going to do research in there, is a much broader sample size of people that can be involved in it. And the types of research. We can test things out here mm-hmm. before they go up into space.
So are these expeditions funded by NASA and other scientific organizations or by industry? Or do you have to pay for it on your own?
So both.
Okay. All right.
Again, it's not very organized, mm-hmm. but there are ways to apply for federal funding. You can propose missions. I know NASA does the HERO solicitation, which is where you can submit research and then propose to do that research inside of space analog habitats. Like our mission, for example, was funded by a commercial entity. And so we were able to have mm-hmm. go out and find that sponsorship to be able to do the mission. Others, you can just pay to play, essentially. Mm-hmm. You can pay into a mission or join a crew that needs somebody, or you pay to do an entire mission depending on what you're trying to achieve.
So have you heard of stories where people just didn't get along and they kind of wanted to kill each other?
Yes. Especially the longer missions.
Off the island?
Yeah.
How does that get resolved if you're sort of in that locked in environment? You know, I always tell people when you go to Mars, you can't throw someone, you know, out the window.
No. Well, you shouldn't.
You shouldn't do it. Right.
That wouldn't be so good.
Not good.
No. So, you know, there have been instances where missions have ended because mm-hmm. like analog missions have ended because of that. But, you know, one thing with this community building right now is there's a lot of attention being brought to pre-training activities mm-hmm. to make sure that, the crews, you know, they're not necessarily selecting the crews so they all get along, mm-hmm. but they are evaluating, like, okay, how are things going before they go in the mission, mm-hmm. learn coping mechanisms or conflict resolution skills. And then, you know, one of the things that before the Sensoria mission that I was a part of is we started to do exercises where we looked at what are people's strengths and mm-hmm. what are people's tendencies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinking about like, for example, are you a morning person or are you a night person? Those are really mm-hmm. important things to know about each other because,
sure.
and it sounds so simple, but you know, if you know somebody's not a morning person, like don't talk to them in the morning and you might, not end up in some sort of, issue or argument. So anyway, so the community is starting to come together mm-hmm. about that and to make sure that, you know, the tools are there to support it. And then if they're in a longer mission, that they have ground support as well, like a psychologist available or, you know, like mm-hmm. people that are available to help them as they go through the longer missions, but
so giving them the resources to learn how to cope. Now you took it to another level. You actually have a graduate degree.
Yes.
And you are enabling others to quote unquote reach for the stars. You were very involved, for example, in the Inspiration 4 mission and Sion Proctor's involvement. Can you fill us in how you moved from what you had been doing to how you graduated literally into the graduate program and then bringing others with you?
Yes. So while I was at NASA supporting that kind of educational outreach side, mm-hmm. I started to, and I had been there 6 years, and I started to realize, okay, I've always been in a role where I'm a leadership role or like training others. And I thought, mm-hmm. okay, how do I get on the ground training astronauts? Like, how does one get there? mm-hmm. And I started to go through that exploration process. Okay. And a lot of the feedback I was getting was, oh, you have to have an engineering degree. You have to have an engineering mm-hmm. degree. And I was like, I'm not having that.
not going to do that one.
But it's not that I don't have an engineering mind. It's just mm-hmm. I don't need to go back and get an engineering degree to mm-hmm. do that. Like in my mind, I was like, there are other ways and we can explore those. And so I searched for schools that would be open to me creating a program, like a new mm-hmm. master's degree that included different areas that I was passionate at the time. There's the human spaceflight part. There's mm-hmm. the education part. But then there was also the outdoor adventure side of things, which was something that for me personally, I was like, if I'm going to leave my NASA job, I better I better have a good time while I'm at it. And sure. So I ended up finding a school. It was a much smaller school here in Arizona called Prescott College. Mm-hmm. And they had a program called Adventure Education. And so it's teaching through adventure experiences. And so I met with the team there and I said, okay, how do I merge with the space side of things? Like, how do I get this to be what I needed to be to get me into this next phase, which is training astronauts? And at the time, my advisor, she said, space is the ultimate adventure. Let's work together. We can pull in all the SMEs and experts that I know from aerospace and Johnson Space Center and astronauts to give input on the curriculum that I was developing for this master's. So essentially I designed the master's and then took all the courses that I designed. And I will say, and they were validated at the master's level through the university and all these other partners, but it was a really interesting way to learn because you have to do a lot of research to design a course. Right. And then you have to go and learn the information afterwards. So you already know so much and then you really learn it. And so I think like for me, I feel like all education should be done this way because it opened my mind because I got to research the stuff that I was passionate about mm-hmm. and then go into a deep dive into that information by reading all the papers, reading the books, mm-hmm. Reading all the literature that's out there.
And you literally did those deeper dives too.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that was the step that I took in that direction. So that led me to the next step, which was around that time, I actually had met with Mariah Tanner, the CEO mm-hmm. of Star Harbor. Mm-hmm. And we were talking and I was like, hey, do you need somebody to come help out while you're building up Star Harbor? And she's like, okay, what do you want to do? And we just started, I started helping out and quickly found myself in a role of the vice president of training programs and starting to develop everything.
So can you share with us, for those who don't know, what is Star Harbor?
So Star Harbor is a 50-acre campus that's being built in the Lone Tree, Colorado area. And it's a space training and R&D campus. And so right now we're in the process of designing the facilities, developing the curriculum to support space training for the commercial space industry and others. Mm-hmm. But also to become a research and development facility that can support the whole industry that to get research prepared and technology readiness levels up to be able to get them up into space. And so we're trying to create one location where you can do all the space training and all the research activities there, so that, you know, it's a way to increase the speed at which people prepare to go to space.
So, Erin, do you see the theme throughout your life here? Everything you've been doing is, one, you're opening up space for all, you're opening up environments for everyone, but you're also doing it at warp speed. So it's like this perfect combination for you. And you've already kind of done this. You were involved with the Inspiration4 mission. Cyan Proctor is also involved with Star Harbor. And it seems just like this perfect coalition of explorers coming together.
Yeah. And I'll say Cyan Proctor is one of my really good friends. Mm-hmm. And when she was selected to go up on the Inspiration4 mission as the pilot, she couldn't tell anybody yet when she was first selected.
And it must have been so hard.
Oh my gosh. And no, she's, you know, and then, you know, she was told, hey, you've got to sign all these forms, like basically mm-hmm. like NDAs and things like sure. that. And, but you have to have a witness. And she's like, how can I not tell anybody?
Exactly. Kind of contradiction
and,
there.
Yeah. And so, so she asked me, she told me, and asked me to be that witness. And what was great about that is me working in human spaceflight and training and focused on the commercial industry and her being part of the first all civilian crew to go up into space, into orbit. You know, it was this kind of perfect connection point. And she's like, I want your help going through all of this, the training, the what's happening, like it's all new. Right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
How does somebody prepare for all of this? And mm-hmm. so I stepped in like an advisory role with her throughout her entire training. And then she asked me to come into quarantine and live with her and her brother, one of her brothers mm-hmm. and another friend and the whole crew and their families for the week before the launch. And so that was a really unique experience to see that, like, how do these new commercial civilian astronauts, what kind of support do they need in that time period? And it was from the time she was selected to the time she flew, it was about 6 months, mm-hmm. Which is pretty fast for training an astronaut.
Absolutely. And getting, you know, like usually it years.
Historically, but I don't think it was wrong either. Mm-hmm. And I think they were adequately prepared, but they did need a lot of support. And I think one of the infrastructure to support civilian astronauts isn't quite there yet. And so it was like building as they were going through everything. So that was kind of, it was great for me to be alongside her as she went through all of that, to be able to see that so that we can support that long-term with Star Harbor.
So you're vice president of training for Star Harbor. How will that experience, how has it influenced what you want to do with Star Harbor and your training programs?
It's very much influenced it because mm-hmm. it's a different perspective. You know, we're including a lot of what the lessons learned from NASA over the many years. I mean, they are the experts in this. Mm-hmm. However, there are different types of people that are going to be flying and they're going to need different levels of support. And astronauts now are, you know, aren't necessarily, this wasn't their career path, right? Like they weren't preparing to be astronauts forever. Or at least, you know, head in that direction. In the case of Dr. Cyan Proctor, she was selected through a Twitter competition.
It's so interesting.
Yeah.
We can use the tools that we have now to take us to the next level.
Yep. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things. And I think one of the areas that really stood out, during that particular mission was the concept of family support mm-hmm. And astronaut support. So mm-hmm. making sure that not just the training part, going through the training and all of that, it's how are they doing? Like, is their family okay? Does their family have all the information they need to understand mm-hmm. what's even happening? Mm-hmm. Like if they don't come from a career of aerospace, like they might not even understand what a launch is. You know,
so, just start with the basics.
Yeah. And having seen these families go through it and not understand, you know, the different phases of a launch and where there's higher risk and, you know, those things. And I think those are areas where it was really clear, like long term, we're going to have to provide more support even than I think with some of the NASA astronauts, because, you know, their families have really are not prepared for this at all. And in some cases, the astronauts aren't as well.
So it really does take that proverbial village to put someone into space. So if you could say in just like one or two sentences, what is the most powerful thing a person needs to do if they want to reach for the stars, literally?
Yeah, that's a good question. I got some advice.
And that's what we need.
Yeah, I got some advice from a mentor. Actually, it was a coach of mine when I was first starting to skydive, which is a whole other story in itself. But and, you know, one thing about skydiving is it's cloudy sometimes and the winds are high. And like there are a lot of reasons you're not going to be jumping out of the plane and you're going to be sitting on the ground waiting. And the advice that I got from this one instructor was, if you don't show up, you don't jump. And so it might say it's going to rain that day, but if you don't show up and hang out there until there's a hole in the clouds that you can jump through, you know, you'll never get that experience. And so that's something that I've taken to heart and have lived by since that moment. Is when opportunities come up, take them, like go after them. Don't say no, or, oh, it's a little outside of your comfort zone, or, you know, things like that. Like give it a try, like, cause you know, it'll open up new opportunities. And if not, you'll have experienced something new, which increases the breadth of your knowledge. And I think that's a big one for me.
So you're bringing in that humanistic approach. Sometimes we're asked in the space community, why do we even need humans? Can't everything just be done with robots? Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about that? And have you ever trained a robot?
Oh, no, I have not trained a robot. Well, although I have started using the AI image generators, which is kind of like training a robot. But that topic is interesting to me because in my mind, my instinctual response is, why not send both to space?
Complimentary.
Yep. And I think we do already. And you know, humans, our nature is to explore, to push our limits, to increase our, you know, knowledge as a society. And so we will explore anyway. And so we're not going to stop at space. As humans.
True.
However, I'm very comfortable with the idea of robots going first and checking things out, like we're doing on Mars with the Mars rovers and satellites and other missions there, is go check it out, see what's going on, and then send people there. Or have robots go build habitats, build, like set up the settlement that's going to be there. And then the people can go. And it does eliminate some of the risk there, but I would hate for us to stop exploring as humans, because if we can create the technology to support humans living in these hostile environments of space, the moon, Mars, think of all that technology that's going to help us here on Earth and make life better for us here.
Absolutely, completely, 100% agree with you. Erin, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us, as well as your creativity. And I look forward to one day hopefully training with you so that we can both go to the stars.
Yes.
I often say I'll be over the age of 90 probably by that time, but at least I'll be there and bring that generation with me.
Yep.
It's just such a pleasure to work with you and to share your wisdom with our audiences. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And until next time, we're always searching. Thank you so much for listening to Always Searching. Please share it with your community. This podcast was produced by Noah Jones and hosted by me, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. Until next time, we're always searching.